I will try and walk so I don't get too stiff. John and I need to survey this area, as we are only safe here temporarily. Dark Night. February 18th, 2302 hours. There are sporadic gunshots in the wind. We picked up a distress call on the harbor radio from a family in the outskirts of Victoria, Texas, 50 miles from current location. The signal was faint and we tried to respond. However, they could not hear us as they kept transmitting over and over, as if we weren't there. I thought about it and decided that it would not be worth a 50-mile trek through hostile territory to find a group of people that may be dead when I got there. Sad. I used to be more compassionate and chivalrous. I guess after seeing bad things happen to good people, you just don't want to be good. They are trapped in an attic with those things shuffling around below. I think I know who will be able to wait longer. I guess they must have moved the essentials up to the attic when the SHTF. Something keeps eating at me, as if a shell of my former self were ordering me to do something. Or maybe I do have a conscience left. Doubt it. I'm walking now, but not running. John and I unfastened the chain that held the floating ramp to the marina. We found some rope in the utility room of the marina office and use it as part of our drawbridge mechanism. John and I thought of it today. When we are here, we simply pull the rope and the floating ramp gets pulled away from the shore to the marina, making a hard time for any of those fuckers to get here. I hope they can't swim. February 19th, 1524 hours. We are making good headway in securing the area. There are numerous small boats in the marina, and John and I have pulled the ones we think are worth a damn to our location. I want to check them all at once to avoid starting the engines at different times, making too much noise. This morning I saw a group of 8 dead pass the street about 50 meters from the water's edge. The only thing that troubled me was that they were moving faster than the previous creatures we have encountered. By no means were they running or even jogging, but they definitely were not walking. My heart sank as I noticed the speed at which they moved. I crossed the gangway to the ferry next to the marina office. It was a medium-sized ferry that could fit about 20 vehicles. I assumed it was used to cross the channel to mainland Texas. I climbed to the top deck and checked the bridge. I found a set of binoculars, left my others at the tower, and used them to try and spot the pack of dead. I looked up and down the beach and checked the windows on the hotels. No signs of life. I counted 5 windows on the 5th and 6th floor in the nearest hotel, Hotel LeBlanc, that did have occupants. Dead, rotting occupants that will never check out of their hotel. These binoculars were built for sea service. They are large, heavy, and had powerful magnification. They're not really suitable to carry around, but great for checking the area. 3 of the monsters just stood there at the window, staring out. One of them seemed as if it looked right at me. The 2 others looked like they were pacing the room. I wonder how they died. My leg is much better now, and I think I will be able to run on it if need be in a couple days. We are out of food today, so we are going to burgle the vending machines until I can run again. Then we will scavenge for food. I could only salvage 500 rounds for the Car 15. John has 1,000 for the Semi-Auto 22. 22:23 hours. 30 minutes ago I heard a noise. I donned the night vision goggles and expected to see another raccoon. Not the case this time. 4 of them are standing at the water's edge looking toward our location. They aren't making any noise. They are just standing there with arms swinging ominously at the water's edge. John and I are being as quiet as possible. I'm conserving battery power by leaving the goggles off, but it seems every splash the water makes as it hits the marina pontoons, I imagine them swimming toward us. February 20th, 1854 hours. I was up all night last night. The fog on the water made it impossible for me to see the shore after midnight. This morning, when the sun came up and burned some of the fog away, I checked for them. I could hear some noise in the distance. It sounded like someone was knocking over tin cans. My leg is feeling much better. Today, we lived off of stale candy bars and soft drinks. Makes me think, there will probably never be another can of this made. Sort of depressing. I'm going to need a watch soon, as the battery in this one has been the same for over 2 years. I guess I will put that on the list of must loot. Although, some would argue that stealing to stay alive is not looting. I say it's just details. I'm not planning to raid a jewelry store, but I won't turn down something that will keep me alive. On a lighter note, John and I found a radio station still broadcasting music. Too bad it's automated and keeps looping every 12 hours. Still, good for morale, and I'm glad it's still working. You can almost imagine it is live. It helps. A little. February 21st, 0800 hours. We are in dire need of provisions. Plenty of water here at the marina in the drinking water dispenser, but we have been living off of caffeine and sugar. A detailed map of this area would be very helpful, although getting to it may prove fatal. Early this morning, as the sun was rising through the fog, I could hear and see many of them walking the street in front of the ferry marina. For some reason, they were moving together. Seemed like they were attracting themselves to the noise they were making. I couldn't see the whole group of them, but from the numbers I did see, I could estimate that there were hundreds. John and I picked the best boat out of the few that we rounded up a few days ago. I checked the fuel tank and saw that it was 3/4 full. There was a fuel pump on the marina, so decided to see if it still worked. Went into the marina office and checked for a pump switch. Number 2 pump switch was still on. I went out to use pump number 2 to fill the boat up. No joy. The pump worked, however no fuel came forth. It must have been drained when the shit went down. I went back inside to flip pump number 1 back online. Squeezed the nozzle, and it pumped for a few seconds before any fuel came out. A nice rainbow of fuel was present on the surface of the water. In another time, that might have cost me a fine. A few seconds of pumping, and the last 1/4 of fuel was added. I found a couple empty plastic gas cans in the marina, filled those, and tied them into the boat. John went back in and grabbed my rifle and held it at the ready toward the shore while I worked. We still had no idea what capabilities the dead had when it came to water. Yesterday, while listening to the last radio music broadcasts of mankind, John and I found a metal key box next to a shelf in the administration office. All of the watercraft had a registration number stuck to the side of their hulls with reflective number tape, so finding the key was not a difficult task. I matched the number with the key marked Shamrock 220 and went back out to give her a shot. The back end had drifted, facing the admin office door when I walked out. The boat's name was painted on the rear with a half-circle-type banner. It was the Bahama Mama. I jumped onto the stern and walked over to the wheel and inserted the key. John was still sitting on the dock, eyes trained toward the strips of hotels and the street. I slid the throttle to the start position and turned the key. On the second attempt, it started with no problems, and I let it run for about 5 minutes. I sat there smiling at John at how lucky we had been. I turned the key to the off position, and, just as the engine died down, we heard what it had been drowning out. A football stadium of hideous moans echoed throughout the buildings on the island. We could hear Annabelle's reaction from inside the marina. She was upset at the noise, and the hair on the back of my neck was standing up. Now that the engine worked without any doubt, it was time to plan a trip to gather supplies, leaving in the morning. February 22nd, 0403 hours. As the day went by yesterday, the shoreline was home to over 50 of those things, begging for our flesh. Something just isn't right about them. Their numbers have dwindled to roughly 20. Bahama Mama and Company leaving for supplies. Exodus of the Bahama Mama. February 23rd. 2006 hours. Using the night vision goggles, I prepped the boat for an early departure yesterday morning, It was around 04:30 when I started loading candy bars, bottled water, ammunition, and extra fuel cans onto the boat. I brought a pry bar also, in case we had to strong-arm our way into a place. John was prepping our little man-made sanctuary for Annabelle. It would be dangerous to take her with us. She would be fine here in the confines of our little floating hideaway. The 20 or so dead were still walking the shoreline, blind to the night, and hoping for a glimpse of prey. I found some plastic oars inside the maintenance shed and quietly put them in the boat. Never know. John and I boarded the craft, and I untied us. I reluctantly started the engine and checked the movement on the shoreline. Some of the creatures were flailing wildly, and two of them were wading the water up to their knees. The fact that their fear of water was dwindling sent chills up my spine. As we pulled out, I navigated west. I found a chart used for water navigation in the office at the marina. Too bad there wasn't a map of Matagorda Island in there also. I knew the general shape of the island, however, I had no idea of the details. I was now heading toward San Antonio Bay. I was going slow, conserving fuel, and watching out for any dangers that may appear in the light morning fog. My choices were clear, according to the sea chart. I would sail into San Antonio Bay and choose either the west or the east shore. To the west was the small, according to chart, coastal town of Ostwell, and east was Seadrift. Neither John nor I were familiar with either. We both agreed on Seadrift. No particular reason. Perhaps, in the back of my mind, I thought that because of its name, it would be a better suited docking point. The sun was peeking up over the east horizon and was at our backs when Seadrift came into sight. There were numerous long docks, no doubt to provide berth for fishing vessels. I cut the engine, and John and I started rowing toward the docks. Noise was a luxury we could not afford. Using the binoculars taken from the large ferry, I scanned the coastline. They were here. I could see their pitiful frames walking aimlessly up and down the main street that ran the length of the bay. There weren't many, but enough to be trouble. The sign for the marina read, Dockside Fishing Center. One of the boats berthed here held a deadly crew. John and I saw three of the creatures walking the deck of the fishing boat, only 40 meters away. They saw us, and one of them lunged out at us, falling off the boat, disappearing into the murky waters of the bay. As we rowed closer to the dock, it appeared that there was a small grocery and bait store right off the pier. At arm's length of a tie-down, I secured the mama to the dock. John and I carefully stepped onto the worn wooden planks of the pier. I grabbed the pry bar and stuck it under my belt. Every creak seemed like thunder. The sound of the dead walking on the other boat was much louder than we were, but it was still quiet. There were no sounds of nature and no engines. Even the bay water splashing on the shore seemed muted. The gangway to the boat containing the two remaining ghouls was still in place. They were a threat. I had John keep their attention. He waved his arms at them as I snuck over to the gangway plank, linking the boat to the dock, and quietly slid it into the water. The splash was louder than I expected, and they immediately turned toward me and let out the all-too-familiar moan. Crabs lined the deck of the fishing vessel with the two corpses. Dead fish could be seen in a pile on the stern. The stink was incorrigible. The crabs were snapping at the pant legs of the dead. There were several crab carcasses littering the deck. Legs were pulled off and shells were cracked. Upon a closer look at the undead creatures, I could see that several of their teeth were missing or broken. The bastards were trying to eat the crabs. John and I left the motley crew of ghouls and headed for the grocery store. Weapons ready, we approached the front door. No movement. Damn, I was hungry. Just thinking about all of the food in there made it worse. In my right arm, I had my rifle at the ready. In my left, I tightly held the black steel pry bar. The little grocery store was no bigger than a tennis court. Hurricane shutters were in place, prohibiting any view of the inside, except through the glass front door. Two signs hung on the inside of the door, closed and help wanted. The latter was an understatement. Walking up to the door, I grabbed the handle and pulled. no dice. It was going to have to be the hard way. Using the bar, I slid it between the door and the frame and began prying. I wasn't going to be surprised this time. I thought back to that Walmart. Seemed like ages ago. I nervously watched the inside for movement as I grunted and struggled with the locked door. John was becoming a good point man. He was scanning for movement, covering me. Finally, after a few minutes of struggling with the door, I finally got it open. The store was dark, and it was very warm inside. I could smell rotten fruit. I turned the light on that was mounted on my weapon. I panned the area, listening for anything out of the ordinary. John and I each grabbed carts and made our way to the canned goods section. Quietly, we filled our carts with anything that could be eaten and drank, starting with non-perishables first. All the bread was moldy, but some of the cookies were still good. Of course, the canned goods were fine. The refrigerator section was totally rotten. I panned my light through the glass and saw the yellow-looking gallon milk jugs and molded cheese. Then, something else caught my eye. There was movement in the freezer. I always knew there was a walk space back there for the stock boys to stock the cold goods. It appears that the stock boy and another friend were still in there. The light excited them, and I could see them pounding on the shelves full of milk. In one section, one of them was crawling through the shelf to the refrigerator door that led to us. John and I decided it was time to leave. We wheeled our carts back to the front, and I checked the area for any signs of the enemy. I opened the front door, and John wheeled out first. As I followed, I could see the refrigerator door open at the back of the store, and heard the sound of a body falling to the floor. I knew it was Mr. Stockboy, wanting to check to see if we were finding everything all right. John and I hurriedly jogged back down toward the pier. The carts were making a lot of noise, and I didn't wish to wait around and see how things worked out. Quickly, we loaded the boat with the provisions. Behind us, the front door to the grocery store was creeping open, and I could see the pale figure of the creature that was in the refrigerator section. John and I jumped in the boat, and I kicked us away from the dock. We paddled as fast as we could, and stopped about 10 meters out from where we were tied up. It was time for a break. Using my knife, I opened up a can of cold beef stew and drank down the contents. John did the same. As we sat there, drinking bottled water, our friend on the pier was giving us a warm bon voyage. The creature looked horrible. It was missing a right hand and most of the jaw. It was wearing a long white apron with something written on it in blood. I pulled out my binoculars, and in simple block letters it read, "If you can read this, kill me." I smiled at this and thought to myself that I would have liked to have known this man when he was alive, as I appreciated his sense of humor. I slung my weapon to my shoulder and selected single shot. I then took aim and shot Stockboy in the head. John gave me a, "Why did you do that?" look, and I just glanced at him and said, "Professional courtesy, my friend. Professional courtesy." The trip back to our marina stronghold was uneventful. About a quarter mile from the pier, we cut the engines and quietly rowed to the dock. There weren't any of them on the shore, probably because they followed the sound of our engines away from the marina early this morning. We quietly unloaded most of the food and water. It was dinner time for Annabelle. It's funny how she probably eats better now than she did before all of this. February 24th, 2047 hours. John and I talked about family. I told him that I was worried about mine, and that I doubted they lived through this, even considering their location. John told me about his son, and about how proud he was of him, and how he had gotten a scholarship to Purdue. He went on to tell me the antics of his recent family reunion, and how his wife couldn't get along with his mother. John asked me why I joined the service. I told him my story of how I was a poor country boy from small-town USA that wanted to serve his country, and how I came up the hard way through the enlisted ranks. Not that it matters now what my rank is anyway. I'm sure somewhere deep underground in the Northwest United States rank still matters, but not here on this two-bit marina on some no-name island. I went on to tell John why I didn't stay with my comrades at the base. I paused at this, questioning to myself whether or not I should have fought the good fight. I told John that sometimes I regret not going to the base with my fellow officers. The point of the matter is, I am alive and they are not. I would rather choose needle in a haystack over jackass in a fortress. I expressed to him that I would have to live with my decision, but at least I'm alive to do it. John looked at me and said, "You speak as if I'm accusing you of desertion." I apologized and told him that it was a sensitive subject. I guess I am a deserter. Who is alive to tell? I suppose if things ever get back to normal, I will. No use thinking about that. My heartstrings tugged at the thought of my parents being bored up in their attic, praying for help. My imagination could almost see their dirty clothes, matted hair, and malnutrition-riddled frames. I had to compartmentalize this thought to keep from making a bad decision. Willingly attempting to save my parents, whom are hundreds of miles away, would be suicide. I wonder how long it took for the devastation to reach the backwoods of Arkansas. It didn't take long from the time I saw it on the news to the time it was outside on my street, clawing at my wall. It is a cold decision to make. However, if I wish to live, I cannot let emotion tell me where to point my steps. Even in the best case, a minor lapse in judgment would mean death. If I chose to go to Arkansas to see if my parents still lived, every decision would have to be perfect, right down to where I chose to sleep at night and where I chose to scavenge for supplies. What went wrong? I don't know why it has taken me almost 2 months to really think about it. What sick fuck would do something like this? I assumed too much. Was man reaching the level of deity? Maybe it was something larger. I don't want to think about that right now, as I would only curse and scream, and if it was something bigger, I didn't want to take the chance of this higher force reprimanding me for being insubordinate. So for now, I guess we will have our little unspoken agreement. If you exist, let's just leave each other alone. I'll let you know when I'm ready. I don't fear the Reaper. February 25th, 1932 hours. The coast was clear earlier today when I took Annabelle out to stretch her legs on the dock. I walked her up and down the wooden planks. I could tell she had put on a couple of pounds and needed a little exercise. I kept her muzzle on to avoid any loud barking. The marina resembled a system of docks that would look like an H from the air. The floating marina office was attached to one side of the H, and a single floating ramp was the only thing that formerly connected this artificial island of wood, metal, and foam to the real island. I walked her around the perimeter of the dock. Yesterday, I took a long fishing pole from one of the boats and tried to touch the bottom from the point on the dock closest to the shore. I couldn't touch, so that meant that the water was at least 9 feet deep in that area. For some reason, I feared that they might be able to wade the water and just climb up here. I felt a little more assured after my depth finder test. On our second walking lap around the marina, Annabelle started sniffing the wind, and the familiar scene of her hair standing up on her back became obvious. She sensed them. The wind was blowing from the shore, and we were downwind. I picked her up and took her inside. I went to the window facing the shoreline and waited. I told John what she had done while we were outside. John and I shared the window and just kept watching. The sounds came first, and it reminded me of the sound of a distant street sweeper being carried by the wind. Then, the mass of them came slowly, stumbling, and even walking by. There was no way to count them, and I knew that if they wanted, they could get to us here on the marina. When I saw them pass by our location, it reminded me of a big city marathon. All it would take would be the sheer number of them piling themselves up on the water. I was getting tired of running, but this is a big island, and I'm sure that we could never find enough weapons or ammunition to kill them all. If only we had a few more days back at the tower in Corpus to plan. John is picking up faint signals from the survivors trapped in the attic. That is another thing that is getting at me. February 26th, 09:23 hours. John and I were monitoring the radios this morning. It seems our attic survivors are still okay. We are still unable to raise them with our transmitter. The man's name is William Grisham, and he is making all of the broadcasts. From time to time, I have heard a female voice in the background, but I can't tell if it is a child or his wife. He says that they are not infected and have enough food and water to last a week, but the sounds of the corpses below are driving them mad. He doesn't seem to think that they can make it out alive without help. Looking at the air chart that I still have, we could take the boat back to Seadrift, then find a car there and try to make it the rest of the way to Victoria, Texas. I don't even know why I'm thinking this. The whole trip looks like about 50 miles, 10 of which are on the water. That means 80 miles of round-trip danger. I can't ask John to go, and actually, I would prefer that he stayed here. John is torn between doing the right thing and possibly losing his fellow survivor, or doing the wrong thing and losing his soul. My thoughts are happening in phases. I would hate to be in that position, but I was in that position, and I did something about it. I chose to live. 21:45 hours. William has been broadcasting off and on all day. He sounds desperate. I can't stop listening because it is another human voice. His maddening ramblings are bringing my mind into a maze of darkness. I feel I must help. John and I have discussed it at length, and he will stay and hold down the fort with Annabelle. I almost feel like I am starting to get to know William. For some odd reason, he rambled on for about 30 minutes, just talking about whatever was on his mind. I assume that shock may be setting in, and he is using the radio as an emotional outlet. He spoke of his job, and how he was a chemist before all of this happened. I listened to his voice, and could almost hear his honesty and integrity about the fear of losing his family. I feel I must help. Tonight I will prepare, and tomorrow I will go. February 27th, 08:20 hours. Leaving shortly. I will be taking the boat back to Seadrift, then the rest either by car or on foot. This could take a few days. I found a CB radio on one of the boats here. It's a little heavy and battery-powered, but when I get within range of William's radio, I will use it to try and hail him. No use going the last 20 miles only to find William and family as one of them. I have nearly 500 rounds left from what I salvaged in my rush from the control tower, taking into account the one round used to shoot the stock boy in the head. With the radio, water, weapons, rounds, food, and other small miscellaneous gear, I am carrying over 70 pounds. This is why a car would be preferable. My plan is to acquire a road atlas when I get to Seadrift, then shadow the roads all the way to Victoria, if I am on foot. I can't risk being seen by anything living or dead along the way. I will stay in contact with John as long as the handheld will transmit. I do not know its transmit range, but I am sure I could talk to him from Seadrift, as the signal will travel further over the water. Last night, I was outside looking at the stars when I saw a bright green streak in the sky, similar to a shooting star. The green was probably the copper burning up inside a satellite that has long been forgotten. Only a matter of time before GPS fails, along with all other satellite-based services. Enough useless babble. Time to cock the hammer. 18:44 hours. I paddled the boat out to about 1/4 mile distance from the marina, as to not attract them to John. Had to gas up the boat last night. When I turned on the engine, I cruised west a bit to attract them away from the marina, just to give John a little more peace of mind. Didn't take long for me to reach Seadrift, as it is only about 10 miles from the marina to the mainland Texas. Once again, I shut the Bahama Mama down and did my best to paddle, with one oar, the rest of the way. When I reached the same marina John and I were at a few days before, I noticed that the same two creatures on the fishing boat, and the re-dead stock boy face down on the dock. He was being picked apart by a group of birds. Before approaching any of the docks, I tried the CB radio on the pre-selected channel that John and I agreed on. After the second attempt, I heard John's faint crackling voice asking me if everything was okay. I told him that everything was fine, and that his friends on the fishing boat were having crab this evening, and wondered if he would be attending. He laughed at this, and I told him that I would get back to him as soon as I got back into range. I knew that there was another creature inside the grocery store. I could see faint movement on the street about 1/4 mile north inland. I could see what looked like another set of marina docks further up the shoreline. It was too far to paddle without another oarsman. I had to start the engine. This excited the creatures on the fishing boat, and it felt as if every set of eyes left in the world were staring at me, angry for the broken silence. As I sped up the coastline, the creatures on the beach took notice of my boat and started following me up the waterline. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. These creatures were not the same slow, shambling creatures I was used to. Some of them seemed to move faster. One of them appeared to be almost trotting, with its arms reaching out toward my boat. They were still very uncoordinated, and many of them were falling face down in the sand, only to get back up to pursue me. I decided to distance myself from the shoreline and approach the dock in a manner that would not attract this ragtag bunch to my position. I took the boat 1 mile out into the center of the bay and approached the dock in a perpendicular direction. I tried to build up enough speed so that when I cut my engine, I could drift at least most of the way. Not being familiar with this dock, my weapon was at the ready as I inched closer. It was very similar to the east dock in many ways. I saw no dead in this area. There was a gas station in plain view about 300 meters from the marina. I shuddered when I thought of being on the roof of the last gas station back home. My fear started to grow as the view to the gas station became clear. I finally cut the engine and drifted as far as I could without using the paddle. I eased into the marina and tied the boat down. I checked the area for immediate danger, and then checked the fuel level to make sure I had enough to make it back to Matagorda Island. I turned the CB radio off, as I didn't want any calls breaking the precious silence I was trying to maintain. Shouldering my heavy pack, I stepped up on the dock and began to walk toward the shore, taking extra precaution to watch my footing and minimize noise. I could see 2 vehicles parked in front of the gas station. One of the cars still had the fuel nozzle attached to it, as if the owner never got the chance to place it back on the pump. I could see that the other car, parked in front of the gas station, had the driver's side door open. I knew for sure that the dome light would have drained the battery long before I got here. I made my way closer to the station, weapon ready. I knew that if I had to evade, I wouldn't be able to go more than 3 miles without rest, as it was a chore to move with all the weight. As I approached the car near the pumps, the only sounds I could hear were the sounds of the water churning near the docks. I was at the pump. I checked the gallons readout on the pump to see if the car had actually been filled up. No joy. It was digital, and the power to the pumps was shut off. Quietly, I took the nozzle out of the car and placed it on the ground, then put the fuel cap back on. My best guess was that the car was a mid-80s model. The decals told me the car was a Buick Regal Grand National. It was black. I went around to the driver's side door. The window was open, so I reached inside to check for keys. No keys. I made for the convenience store. The glass display windows and door were shattered, looted long ago. I wasn't there to loot. I just needed a road atlas. I could see the map display on the same counter as the microwave, so I ducked through the broken glass and headed that way. My nose didn't warn me of any dead here. I scanned each aisle as I made for the maps. They were fresh out of road atlases, but I did find a laminated road map of Texas. Since I didn't plan on taking any interstate trips, this would do just fine. It was now time to deal with the keyless Buick. Since this area seemed devoid of current danger, I decided it best to attempt to hotwire the car rather than attempt to find a working car in dangerous territory. I knew that I would be SOL on a newer model car, but this old Buick would be easier. I found the odds and ends aisle and grabbed a small overpriced package of cheap speaker wire, then went to the front counter display cases and took an extremely cheap, poorly made, fake convenience store Swiss Army knife. Leaving the store with my bounty, I checked the area once again and approached the Buick. As I passed the other vehicle parked with its doors open, I was startled by the sound from inside. A squirrel was making itself a nice home, complete with nest in the back seat. I opened the door to the Buick and popped the hood. I followed the plug wires to the coil wire. I took the speaker wire, stripped both ends with the shitty Swiss Army knife, and ran it from the positive end of the battery to the positive side of the coil. This would supply power to the dash. The car would be useless without this. I had to locate the starter solenoid. It was logically found on the starter. Using the longer knife blade on the knife, I completed the connection between the starter solenoid and the positive battery lead. There was a spark. The engine cranked over, then came to life. I would hardwire it later. The noise would surely attract them, so I had to hurry. I took off my pack and weapon and sat them in the passenger seat. Using the flathead screwdriver part of the knife, I was able to push the steering wheel locking pin away from the wheel to unlock it. I then tightened the speaker wire so that it wouldn't come off during the drive. I closed the hood, got in, and then rolled the fucking windows up fast enough to break the sound barrier and headed for the road with a quickness. My lucky day. The poor bastard that owned the car actually filled the tank up before he presumably died. Looking at my map, my route was distinct. I was on Highway 185 northwest out of Seadrift, straight shot into Victoria. The road was far from being a major thoroughfare, so I had no trouble getting to the outskirts of Victoria in less than 2 hours. I was delayed by the occasional car parked sideways in the road, or an unusually large pack of creatures shambling across like sheep. As I approached the outskirts, I could tell that I was closer to a fallout area, as there was a light coat of ash on most horizontal surfaces, i.e. parked cars, houses, and buildings. I am no expert on radiation, but I did see birds and small animals, so I took a chance in assuming it was semi-safe to at least transit the area. Right now, it's nearly 20-30 hours, and I have been trying to hail the Grishams on the radio for the past 30 minutes. No answer. This trip could have been a complete waste. Coming into town, I had to avoid being seen by a group of those monsters. I parked the car within short walking distance of the local Victoria, Texas water tower. No sooner than I was 300 yards away from my car, there were scores of them surrounding it. I have no idea how they can triangulate sounds like they do. A living person would be hard-pressed to do this. My thoughts drifted to the structure of the ear and how the parts must stiffen in death. The sun will be setting soon, and I'm getting tired of riding. I am safely 150 feet off the ground on the tower with my pack. It is drizzling rain, and I am miserable. I will continue to attempt contact with the survivors. February 28th, 09:23 hours. I found them. Not much time to write. I turned the radio on this morning at 0800 hours and walked around to the opposite side of the tower just to make sure on reception. After 3 attempts, William's familiar voice answered up.
Thank God. We need help. Where are you?
I exchanged information with him and told him that I have been picking up his transmission for a few days, and that myself and another man named John were holding up at a marina on an island off the coast of Texas. I asked him how things were, and he said that his position was completely surrounded by the dead. I told him that I was broadcasting from the Victoria Water Tower, and asked him where he was in reference to the tower. The directions he gave were simple, and he was only a couple of miles from my location, leaving now. 16:41 hours.
I have them. William is driving.
After speaking with William this morning, I departed the area to look for them.
I hotwired the car again, much more simple this time, and sped toward the directions that I jotted down in my journal. The house was not difficult to find, as it was the one swarming with at least 100 undead. I could see William's face through the gaping hole where the attic vent once was. Even from this distance, I could see the defeat in his eyes. I don't know what came over me. Maybe I am still human inside after all. There just might be a conscience there. I radioed William to hang tight. I slammed on my brakes, jumped out of the car, and opened fire on the crowd of devils. 100 sets of white eyes immediately turned my way, and I could swear 100 mouths opened in unison and called my name. Of course, my fear was making my eyes see this, but they were coming after me. I jumped back in the car, slammed it in reverse, and turned around. Just when the first of them reached the car and started to pound, I took off, leading them away from William and his family. I keyed the microphone and told William to get his family ready to go out onto the roof as near to the ledge as possible. I was going very slowly so that they would give chase and stay with me. William told me over the CB that they were all following me and that the plan was working. The only ones left behind were the ones I was lucky enough to put down with a random freak headshot when I opened fire. Rounding the block, I waited until they were almost upon me, until I hit the fucking gas and made for the Grisham house. I could see William, his wife, and a little girl on the roof. I drove the car up to the side of the house to lessen the distance they would have to jump. I got out and covered them as William jumped first and held his arms out for the others. One of them came walking outside the shattered front door and saw William's wife as she was sliding down the roof, legs hanging over. It made for her. I took aim and popped the bastard in the mouth. That didn't stop it. I was getting tired. One more round to the dome put it in its place. I swung my upper body back around to the street like a tank turret. Still clear. They were all on the ground. William started to say thanks when I cut him off. The two girls were in the back. William got in and put his seatbelt on. I passed my rifle to William and sped off back toward Seadrift. It is going to be too dark to take the boat back to Matagorda. I have no way to find it in the dark, as I have left the NVGs with John. We are going to have to find a safe place to sleep in or near Seadrift tonight. February 29th, 0643 hours. I could not get John on the radio last night or this morning. We ended up sleeping on the boat. I pulled her out to 100 meters from the marina and anchored her. We were safe, and I actually got some decent sleep. The Buick is parked right next to the dock. Not sure if I will ever need it again, but it is a good car. Leaving in a few minutes for the island with the new survivors. Have not had much time to chat with them, as they slept very deeply as soon as we were safely anchored. The little girl, Laura, whined in her sleep last night. 0900 hours. No sign of John. No note written. Nothing. No sign of struggle. Myself, William, Jan, and little Laura are safe within the confines of the marina. I am worried about John. He is much too conservative to do something like this. Annabelle was happy to see me, but she was especially happy to see Laura. The little girl smiled and was very happy to have a dog to play with. Maybe John took out a boat, and will show soon. Stand. March 1st. 1322 hours. There is still no sign of John. I feel like I need to look for him, but I have no idea where to start. What would make him leave with no notice? His weapon is gone, and the drawbridge mechanism we rigged is drawn back. It is all very confusing. I am taking this downtime to get to know the Grisham family a bit better. They do not know John, but can see the worry in my eyes that I am trying to hide. March 3rd, 0914 hours. John was bloody, tired, and defeated. He came back this morning and called out to me. I ran outside and pushed the marina drawbridge over to him. He fainted at the shoreline, and I had to carry him inside. John isn't a big man, only about 160 pounds. I slung him over my shoulder and walked over the drawbridge, and pulled the rope to slide it back my direction and attach it back to the marina wall. When I got him inside and put him on a makeshift bed, I noticed the photograph in his bloody hand. A blood-stained picture of a woman fell to the floor from his clutch. I knew in my heart who it was. It was his wife. He has been in and out of consciousness since his arrival early this morning. He has taken some water and has attempted to drink some canned soup. Janet and I will continue to monitor him. William's wife, Jan, was a registered nurse, quit her nursing job a couple years ago for medical school. She wasn't a doctor, but who is anymore? Janet examined him head to toe, paying special attention to John's lacerations. None of them appeared to be bite marks. One of them looked like a small caliber bullet wound, entry and exit wound on his shoulder, while others looked like tumble injuries. John was in no shape to explain anything as he could barely take a drink of water, soup, without vomiting and passing out. I am worried. March 4th. 2014 hours. John finally snapped out of it. I told him how worried I was and how I had no idea what happened to him. He then proceeded to tell me that he hit his breaking point during the loneliness of the past few days. While I was away, all he could think of was his wife and son, and how much he loved them. Jan was listening from the adjacent room, and I could tell she felt for him. John told me how he remembered leaving some items in the aircraft when he abandoned it, and he was missing the only picture he had of his wife. He told me that he could never ask me to risk my life over a picture, so instead of waiting on me to get back, he decided that he would attempt to get it on his own. He made it to the ruined aircraft and retrieved the small bag containing the photo, and immediately started heading back. He was soon besieged by many undead, and had to take refuge in a hotel. He managed to barricade the second floor of the five-floor hotel. He then proceeded to clear out any unsecured guests with his .22 rifle. After 3 days and nights of enduring the sounds of the trapped undead guests in their rooms, he decided to make an escape. He went room to room, ensuring they were not occupied, and collected sheets from the vacant beds. Using square knots, he formed a long escape rope. Early on the morning of his escape, he found the right window to climb out of. The window he chose was on the third floor, and a large tree growing near the window obscured street view. He climbed down the sheets with his rifle slung over his shoulder. He dropped the non-breakable gear to the ground. About the time he started climbing down, he felt one of the knots starting to slip on his sheet rope. It was too late to climb back up and check. He continued his descent. The knot gave way as he reached the second floor level. He fell hard and fast through the tree branches and was cut up pretty well on the way down. When he hit the ground, his rifle discharged and the bullet entered the back of his shoulder and exited the front. His next memory was of me carrying him back onto the dock. March 5th, 12:30 hours. Woke up this morning in a cold sweat around 0600. The Grisham family was still sleeping in the other room of the marina. John and I were crashed out on the two couches in the office. I know I had a terrible dream last night, but I just can't grasp what it was. I just remember running. Fast. The first thing I saw when I woke up were the small droplets of blood on the wall, left over from the harbormaster's suicide. John didn't wake up until 11:30 or so. Thankfully, the bullet wound and lacerations don't seem to be critically infected. Just some small reddening around the edges of some of the cuts. Luckily for him, the round passed through his shoulder. He might have died of infection if one of us had to attempt to extract it on our own. Medical supplies would be a nice luxury to have, especially since there is someone around that might be able to use them. Of course, a nice bunker with 8-foot thick steel walls, geothermal power, and unlimited food and water would be nice also. People in hell want ice water. Who am I kidding? There is no more hell. Hell is here. I want ice water. Quiet time. 1944 hours. Laura and Annabelle played in the back room of the marina while Jan, John, William, and myself talked about our experiences. William explained his situation in the attic and how it came to that. John was lying on the couch with his makeshift sling, ironically made from a torn sheet. I expressed the fact that we can't exist here on this island forever. We would never be safe from the hordes that are roaming the streets. What if a hurricane came and washed the marina away, or even worse, washed it up on the shore? A million things could go wrong. We only have limited fuel here for the boats. None of us know how to fix, operate the large ferry docked next to us. I asked William why he had to be a chemist and not a boat mechanic. He apparently has a decent sense of humor for a chemist. I inquired to Jan as to how Laura was taking all of this. Jan expressed that she was unusually resilient to all of the horror she had witnessed in the past couple months. I heard Laura whine in her sleep again last night, but did not mention this to Jan, as I am sure she is no stranger to this. It must be my military nature, but I feel like we are in the same situation as John and I were in at the tower. I feel like we need to make plans, and need to make them fast. I cannot foresee any danger here at the marina, as we have our own little man-made island, but again, John and I had a 200-foot tower surrounded by a high chain-link fence, and were under siege within minutes. Maybe I am just paranoid. We have our code words established for Laura when we see one or more of those things outside. We play quiet time. This lets Laura know that it is not time to play and jump and giggle with Annabelle. Today, one of those things was shambling about, very near the shoreline where the floating walkway would be if it were connected to the shore. Its rotted body was having a difficult time raising its head, but it managed to look in my direction as I peered out the blinds at it. I know the thing is dumb and dead, but I still felt a calculating stare as it kept looking over here. More came soon after. Some looked as if they died recently. These moved faster and more methodically than their rotted counterparts. I would definitely make it a point to avoid them with more zeal. March 6th, 0322 hours. I woke up a half hour ago and cannot get back to sleep, so I decided to check the shoreline with the night vision goggles. I see numerous figures walking around the area near the shoreline. I can hear a sound coming from the direction of the tall buildings. I can't quite figure out what it is. For some odd reason, it sounds like a TV that is turned up too loud. This made me want to check our TV here, but I will wait until it is light outside, so that the light from it cannot be seen on the shore. Why do they remain here? Do they sense us? If I had a suppressed weapon, I would execute the lot of those miserable creatures right now. 12:42 hours. Brainstorming, brainstorming, brainstorming. I spent the whole morning thinking of possible safe areas. Of course, no place is truly safe. All of the heavily fortified buildings or prison facilities would be impenetrable and useless without access. This island will not do. Maybe a smaller island, with less of an undead population. One would think that an island would be ideal in this situation, but there is nowhere to run, and the only supplies on the island are already here. Once we run out of the low-hanging fruit-type supplies that are easily scavenged from nearby buildings, that will be it. William told me of his neighbor and how he was bitten. He swore it didn't take more than a few hours for him to succumb to the wound and turn. It only takes one of them. I read somewhere that even the best thieves concede to the fact that they will get caught eventually. It's just the law of averages. Basing my chances of survival on this premise, I too feel that my day will come. All I can do is attempt to survive. I have never had any children, and I see the worried look in William and Jan's eyes when Laura asks to go outside. That is shit for an existence. I feel somewhat responsible for everyone. I know that if any of them succumb to the dead, I will feel great sorrow. There must be a group of people somewhere. The question is, do I want to make myself known? I move the harbor radio near John's couch so that he could monitor it. He enjoys this, and it gives him something to do while he recovers. I still have my stolen state map of Texas. There aren't many details given about Matagorda Island, but there is a hospital a couple miles south of our position. John's wounds do not seem to be getting any worse, so I'm not sure I will even need to find any medication, but I suppose it's nice to know it's there if I want to risk my ass. No broadcast on the TV. I could have sworn I heard something like it in the distance this morning. One station has a high-pitched ringing sound, but only snow for the picture. The radio station is still playing, and I think I have almost memorized the order of the songs and all the commercials. Just a constant loop until the power goes out or the tape digital feed fails. I wonder what kind of rotting filth is trapped in that DJ booth right now. We are fast approaching spring, and I don't like the idea of being at the mercy of a hurricane if one were to pop up here. I hate to keep moving, but it seems to be the only thing that has kept me alive. March 7th, 21:23 hours. When John and I visited Seadrift on our food-gathering expedition, we put all we could into two shopping carts and got the hell out of there. That amount would have lasted us a while with just us. Now we have three more mouths to feed. John wasn't yet able to handle himself out there, so that leaves William. I approached him about it today. I sort of feel guilty, considering he has a wife and child. I couldn't go out there alone and expect to survive. I needed someone to at least be the eyes behind me while I work. He looked at me and told me that I didn't even need to ask, and then he went on to tell me how grateful he was. I don't take compliments or tributes too well, so I just thanked him and changed the subject. After conducting an inventory of food and water, my best guess is that we have enough food to last a week. Just reading that sounds like great news for a complacent person. I would prefer to have 1 month plus a week for backup. William only has very limited experience with firearms. This would have to change for him to be effective out there. After discussing with William what would have to be done in the coming days, he agreed to let me teach him how to operate John's .22 rifle. We checked the outside for any lurking corpses. We saw only one shambling parallel to our position, preoccupied with something on the ground. I loaded my rifle as well as John's .22 and enough rounds to do what we set out to do. I left my pistols behind for Jan, ready to shoot. I explained to her that she not leave them where Laura could get them, and the basics of how to hold and aim the weapon. I knew they would be safe while William and I were away, and we would only be gone for an hour. William and I quietly stepped onto the boat and untied her. We rowed in unison for 15 minutes so that we would be clear of the marina area. This time, instead of heading toward Seadrift, west, we headed up the coast toward the more populated area of Matagorda Island. No better way to practice than with real targets. I could tell that William was nervous. I told him to relax, and that we were not going to set foot on shore today. This relieved some of his tension and made things seem more pleasant. 20 yards from shore, and very near three large beachfront hotels, was where we anchored the Bahama Mama. I hated to do this to William, but better he sweat in training than bleed in battle. I started making noise and whistling and screaming out to them. It wasn't long before the beach was teeming with dozens of them. Some of them waded knee-deep in the water before stumbling backward to dry land. It was then I started teaching William how to load and fix a jammed weapon. I figured that if he could load while being taunted by the dead, he could do it anywhere. He fumbled and dropped a few rounds on the deck of the boat, but overall, he picked up quickly how to load the weapon and aim it. I took the weapon from him and replaced the loaded magazine with the spare unloaded I had hidden in my pocket, without him seeing. He was gazing nervously at the shoreline when I handed the cocked weapon back to him and told him to aim at the creature in the red shirt. Dramatically, I explained to him the basics of aiming and how he needed a headshot to kill them. Ideally, I told him I wanted the shot to hit on the top one-third of the cranium. I told him to breathe long, deep breaths. Only when he was ready should he squeeze. Then only on the exhale. I was testing him. Would he anticipate the small kick of the .22 and yank the weapon when he depressed the trigger? I told him to take the shot. With both eyes open, like I told him, he gazed through the sights and squeezed the trigger. Click. William jerked high and to the right, his mental reflexes telling him to do so. Then he looked over at me, confused. I told him what I had done and why. Over the next few minutes, I would take the weapon and randomly load around to test him. Soon, he didn't jerk the weapon at all. His first kill was a direct